Summer is here and all I want to do is let my hair down and start making memories again, and it wouldn't be the same without a delicious drink. Personally, over the past year, I've been trying to drink less alcohol as I know it can have a negative effect on my well-being. However, I haven't wanted to compromise on the experience or taste, and that's when I discovered Atopia. Atopia is an ultra-low alcohol spirit, and I mean low, at just 0.5% ABV. It has the same alcohol content as a fresh pineapple. It's infused with a selection of aromatic botanicals and is best served with your favourite tonic and garnish. Oh, and by the way, it contains 75 times less alcohol than a gin and tonic, which means you can go out and still feel fresh the next morning. I can't wait to enjoy summer without compromise with Atopia. So join in the fun and head over to Waitrose to get a bottle so you can start creating your summer drinks today. This podcast will contain real conversations around alcohol abuse and suicide. Listener discretion is advised, so please only listen if it feels safe for you. Hi and welcome to Open Mind with me, Frankie Bridge. Today I'm joined by GP and TV presenter Dr. Zoe Williams. You will have seen Zoe on screens answering questions, raising awareness around loads of important health related issues, but also she was my hero on our trek to Namibia. She literally forced me around that desert, didn't you, Zoe?
There was one particular day where I thought, I just need to keep talking. As long as I keep talking, as long as we were continuing to have a conversation, and we talked about so much crap. But I thought, if I just keep you talking, you were fine. The minute we stopped talking, you know, I could see it was getting difficult for you. But it was quite cool because they kept wanting me to be in the van and I wanted to walk. So, yeah, but it was a great experience overall, and I was so proud of you. You did such a good job.
Oh, no. I wouldn't have been able to do it without you, though. And I do. Oh. I actually can think of that time that you're thinking about, and I do remember thinking, because she talks a lot. But it was great. You must have been like, oh, what do we talk about next?
Look at the colour of the sky.
Oh, it's so nice. That was the point where I'd got to where I felt like the Beatles were taking the piss out of me. That's how bad it had got.
I remember how fast they were.
They were like the only thing that were alive out there. And I was like, they're even faster than me. Oh, dear.
Do you know what, though? It was, I think, just watching you go through what you went through over those few days and to come out the other... I was honestly so proud of you. Proud of Grimmy as well, because he went through a lot in a different way. But honestly, babe, so proud of you. Like, the inner strength that you have. Yeah, very impressed.
Thank you. Still, my toenails are still not fully returned to normal. That's the one thing that, like, I'm still paying for it. But it was worth it.
It's when the medical team would come and treat your blisters and they'd pull out their blade and you're just like, oh, my God.
Oh, it was,
yeah, the physical pain was horrendous. But, yeah, the mental struggle wasn't pleasant either.
During that chat, I remember talking to you about you had not long been with your partner.
Yeah, that's right.
You were just kind of at the beginning stages, right?
Yeah.
And you were saying to me, right, and then I'm going to get back and I'm going to have a baby in March, I think I remember you saying. What month did we do the trek? Was it like before
February. We did the trek in February. And I was like, yep, next period, going to get pregnant, need to have a baby soon, getting on a bit. Going to be 40.
You were just so like, this is it. This is the plan. And you are a mum now.
Yay.
Little baby Lisbon.
Just so
cute. Oh, God, such a lovely. Where did the name come from?
So Stuart and I actually met in Lisbon in September. So we went on the trek in February 2020. And we'd met just a few months before that in September in Lisbon. Yeah, I was there with the girls for the weekend. He was on a work trip, and I don't think it happens this way these days that often, but we just met in a bar. I saw a guy that I thought was attractive. I was walking past him, he grabbed my hand, introduced himself, and, you know, after nearly 40 years of not finding the right person and getting to that point where I was thinking, gosh, you know, the two things I've always wanted out of life was to be a doctor and to be a mum, and, you know, sort of starting to consider going it alone and being a solo parent. And yeah, it's weird, like the moment we met, we both kind of knew that that was it. We were going to be together and have a family. It was, and I'm not a sloppy romantic person, and I wouldn't call it love at first sight, but I would say it was a kind of knowing at first sight.
Mm. And you've, so now you have baby Lisbon, but it wasn't as easy as you had originally thought it was going to be, was it, for you?
No. And I think for me, that I look back now and I think that conversation I had with you, it sounds a bit cocky, doesn't it? Because I'm very aware of fertility issues. I've myself, luckily, haven't experienced any severe fertility issues, but I've sort of been in touch with the fertility community for quite some time because I froze my eggs a few years ago because I was looking at solo parenthood and sperm donations. I am very aware of the difficulties that people have when it comes to fertility. So it was quite a flippant comment, but I think that comes from a place of me really, as I get older, obviously I'm a doctor, so I'm a scientist, but the spiritual side of me has really grown and developed. And I do believe that, you know, manifesting and visualizing and believing and putting it into the universe increases the likelihood of it happening. So I think that's what I was doing there, is saying, right, when I get home, this will happen and that will happen, to, I think, increase the chances of it actually happening.
Mm. I loved it. I was like, yeah, you are. I mean, it was great chat for me at the time. And then, so what motivated you, if we go back to when you were a bit younger, what were your reasons for wanting to become a doctor in the first place?
So I first declared that I was going to be a doctor at the age of 3, according to my family. And
impressive.
And so my dad's side of the family are from Jamaica, and my grandparents moved to the UK from Jamaica when they were in their 20s. They moved to Burnley, which is a very white community. But my Jamaican grandma trained to be a midwife, and she did really well, and she ended up sort of running the whole community midwifery services in Burnley. So when I was 3, she bought me my first ever like nurse's outfit that had the little doctor's pack with the stethoscope and all of that. And I loved it. And so she sort of proudly says, oh, when you grow up, are you going to be a midwife like me? And apparently I stamped my feet and said no. And my mum said, oh, maybe Zoe's going to be a nurse. And apparently I again stamped my feet and said no, and said, I'm going to be a doctor. And I think throughout my childhood, throughout my life, I was fascinated by the human body. I've always had a caring nature. I've always just naturally enjoyed looking after people. That's something that's always come naturally to me. And I've just never thought there's anything else that I want to do. So I think from an early age, I was interested. Loved watching Casualty. That was my favourite TV programme.
Like the opposite to me. I can't watch any doctory stuff on TV. I'm like, stresses me out.
Yeah, always like, not enjoyed, but I've never been put off by blood or anything like that. And yeah, and I had quite severe asthma as a child myself. So visited hospital. I was in and out of hospital quite a lot for a period of time with asthma. Loved my consultant, who again, I think was a role model. So I think all those things, the role models, I think were really important, but then also just the two interests in the human body and caring for people.
And was it quite a hard process? Because there's a lot that goes into it, isn't there?
Oh my God, I don't even know where to start, Frankie, with talking through. So it is quite a difficult process anyway. But for me, I didn't take the normal standard route. I've been meaning to go on Instagram and do a post to share the fact that I didn't get the A-level results I needed to go to medical school. In fact, my A-level results probably wouldn't got me into university to do most things. They were pretty awful. And it wasn't because I wasn't capable of getting A's or because I didn't apply myself or because I was lazy. It was just a set of life circumstances at the time that I won't go into, or else this will get really long. But, you know, my life wasn't easy at the time. It was quite chaotic. So I didn't get the A-level results. But I think a message to people, to young people out there, is your grades at school or at college don't define you and don't necessarily define what you'll do in the future. I took time out of education after that. I lived abroad. I lived in Tenerife for a bit. I lived in Ayia Napa for a bit. I worked as a landscape gardener. I sold double glazed windows. You name it, I did it. And years later, I found another route into medical school. And I do believe, you know, if it's your dream, it's your passion, there are multiple ways of getting there. So I actually didn't start medical school until I was 22.
Really?
Yeah, after travelling and working in various jobs and going to university to study biomedical sciences, but then almost kind of managing to convince them to upgrade me to medical school whilst I was at uni. So it wasn't an easy path, but equally, I think depending on your background and where you come from, whether you're male or female, what ethnicity you are, you know, what sexuality, if you have disability, all of these things determine how easy it is to achieve something like getting into medical school. And I did quite a bit of work talking to young people from deprived backgrounds, and, you know, there's no denying it is more difficult for you to get there for lots of reasons. But what I also say is if you do get there, your journey from there on forwards can be less difficult than it is for other people. I certainly found, I would never say medical school was easy, because that would just be not true, and I think it's quite offensive to people who go to medical school. But what I would say is my 6 years at medical school, because it had been so difficult for me to get there, I didn't struggle. I did find it manageable, despite having 3 jobs to pay for it, despite being vice captain of the rugby team and having a really good social life. I found it manageable. So the message being, the harder it is to get to the start line in the first place, the easier it is to run the race.
Well, you just seemed like you just weren't going to give up. That was what you wanted to do, and you just kept on going.
Yeah.
Would you say that when you were younger, you were always quite headstrong? Because I've read that your mum had quite a tough relationship with alcohol as you were growing up.
Yeah.
And did you find that that impacted your mental health when you were younger, or
definitely.
Did you find that quite difficult?
Definitely. So it was in my early teens that my mum started to drink, and she ended up being completely dependent upon alcohol. You know, at the worst, she was drinking 2 litres of vodka a day. So it was bad. And that started in my early teens. And, you know, sadly, she passed away 5 years ago, nearly now, from alcohol, from, you know, the deterioration in her brain and her body. So it was really difficult. It was extremely difficult. I think, you know, really troubling for me as a doctor. I used to be sometimes sat in lectures thinking, you know, I'm training here to help people get better, and I can't even fix my own mum. And I think when you're the child of an addict, there's a lot of conversations, if you can call them conversations, that I have with my mum, where she would say things that I knew she didn't mean, but it's never easy to feel that you're being, you know, second best to a bottle of vodka, or she would say some really, really hurtful things in certain moments. And we know that alcoholics can be very, very abusive. So I think it really has impacted my mental health. And I think it's very difficult, actually, for anybody who has a loved one to watch somebody deteriorate and become addicted and, you know, go through that and it not impact you, especially if in the end, you know, they die because of it. Mum was often suicidal, and she did attempt to take her own life on multiple occasions as well. So I'm always told that I'm very resilient, and I think I am. And I think I'm, especially because of the job I do, I've been able to, in some ways, use my own experiences, as awful as they've been, to possibly have more empathy with patients and understand patients, and, you know, really having had that lived experience, I believe makes me better at my job. But, you know, I have demons in my closet. I have dark days. I have a lot of anxiety that I've been really open in talking about. And I think largely it is linked to the difficulties and the difficult relationship I have with my mum.
And do you find that with your job, mental health is becoming a bigger part of your day-to-day life at work?
Oh, yeah. So much so, especially since the pandemic. I mean, before the pandemic, it was. I work in an area of London where a lot of our patients are living in poverty. It's quite a deprived area, and that's the type of general practice that I choose to do. It's where I believe I can have the biggest impact. But especially in the past year, I think the state of the nation's mental health generally is deteriorated. But I think for those with pre-existing mental health conditions, some people have actually found strength, but for some people it's just been unbearable. And I think one group of people it's affected most is children and young people, particularly children of secondary school age or, you know, university age. I just feel that they're a group where their mental health is really probably across most of the population know, they've struggled and they've been harmed, and we will sadly see the repercussions of that in the future. God, it's all doom and gloom, isn't it, this?
Well, it's all about mental health.
It is, but, you know, but I think recognising that now gives us an opportunity to mitigate some of that harm and damage that's been done. I don't think it's outside of our grasp to support those people. And I know the government are making the right noises now about heavily investing financially in the mental health of young people. But that needs to happen immediately. And, you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow. It needs to happen yesterday.
It almost feels like we've got to the point now where people feel they're able to ask for help and they're able to come forward and say that they need it, but it's not at there. The minute, unfortunately, the help isn't there.
No.
And I think that's the hardest thing.
And I think there is some help there for adults. So for people over the age of 18 who have sort of the symptoms of low mood, anxiety, that's at those stages where it's perhaps just getting to the point where they're thinking there's a problem, then there is a lot of support now. So there's a service called IAPT where you can access talking therapy and you can do it yourself. You can self-refer online or through your GP. But for people who have really, you know, established mental health issues, and for people under the age of 18, there just aren't sufficient resources out there. And yeah, you're right. In some ways, people can come forward and ask for help, and there is some help, but that help isn't, you know, it isn't sufficient or intense enough for many people.
Do you feel like with your experience with your mum when you were growing up and now your experience as a GP, do you find yourself thinking how you'll deal with things with Lisbon or how you'll talk to him about things like mental health?
Yeah, I mean, he's only 10 weeks old. I haven't given him much thought.
Come on, sorry, think about it.
But I think, do you know what, my ethos around this generally is openness. I was a closed book about all this stuff up until about 10 years ago. Like throughout my university, my housemates and those really close to me knew about my mum's problems because they saw it, but I was very closed about it. I was quite ashamed of it. I felt that it reflected badly on me, as did my own mental health issues. So I didn't speak openly, and what I've found through my own experiences, the more I've opened up and the more I've shared, actually the opposite is true. And it's helped so many people, me sharing my own experiences. And it's helped me actually, because I've had such positive feedback and people, you know, showing me and telling me and explaining to me how to have done what I've done and achieve what I've done despite the difficult times I've been through. That is something to be proud of, not be ashamed of. And I think you only learn that when you become brave enough to actually open up and share and start talking. And also all of my friends and people who have then opened up to me and said, oh, I've experienced similar. Oh, I've been through this. Oh, I'm so glad you shared that. Now I feel I can open up to you about this. It really does open up a whole new world where, for somebody like me, where I like to help other people and I like to know what's going on in people's lives, and I keep it in strict confidence. It, you know, helping other people helps me. So I once had some really good advice from a therapist. I finally started having therapy 3 years ago, and I had therapy for 6 months and it helped me so much. And I remember my therapist saying, you know how you benefit so much from helping other people. Why do you benefit so much from helping other people? I said, well, it gives me a sense of purpose. It makes me feel proud. It makes me go to bed that night thinking I helped somebody today and it makes me feel worthy. And she said, by not asking for help from the people that love you and care about you, by keeping it all to yourself, by trying to be brave and trying to be strong and not sharing your own struggles, that's quite selfish in a way. She said, because you're not giving those people that you love and care about the opportunity to feel the benefits that you feel when you help them. And reframing it that way really helped me open up and think, you know, by sharing my issues and problems and allowing people I care about to help me and support me, I'm doing them a favour, not being a burden.
Yeah, that's such a good way of thinking of it, because it makes you feel worthy, and like you can go, like you said, like you can go to bed and feel good about helping someone. You can do that for someone else by letting them help you. Exactly. But it's funny, people like you, like GPs or people that have always had to be strong and look after other people, always find it so hard to be looked after.
Yes. Yeah, I find it very uncomfortable being looked after. And even Stuart was, Stuart, that's my partner, he, when, you know, going through the pregnancy and whenever I was seeing the midwife, and we had a doula who was amazing, but whenever the doula would come and visit, he'd say, you're doing it again. They're walking through the door, they're coming to help and look after you. And as soon as they come through the door, you're trying to find out what problems they have that you can help them with. It's not about them, it's about you. Can you just let them help you? So in the end, I had this really frank and open conversation with my doula and said, look, I have this tendency and this awkwardness around being looked after. So I'm throwing that out there so you know. And, you know, that really helped. And it helped me, you know, hand that looking after role over to them.
Are you planning a party, a barbecue, or even a garden soiree this summer? Now we're getting used to hosting again, we have to cater to all the needs of our guests. Lots of my friends and family don't like to drink too much alcohol, but love the taste and the celebration, and there's no reason why they should lose out. I always make sure to have a bottle of Atopia on hand so I can rustle up a quick Atopia and tonic for the designated drivers, expectant mothers, or those who just want to take a night off. And it even goes down well with the big drinkers too. I believe moderation shouldn't come with a compromise. To get started on your cocktail journey, head over to Atopia Spirits to get inspired.
How have you found having Lisbon and then, you know, letting anyone help you? Have you had much help? Have you needed much help?
It's just us really, because it's Stuart and I, neither of us have family that live nearby. Stuart's mum, Granny, came and spent 4 nights with us and it was amazing. I mean, Stella is lovely. She's wonderful. And, you know, just even things like getting up in the morning and somebody had emptied the dishwasher. It was like, oh, such help and a relief. And then we went out for dinner and she looked after Lisbon. But apart from that, it is just the two of us. So Stuart obviously just had the 2 weeks of paternity leave and then he's been back at work, but able to work from home a couple of days a week, which is great. And I've just started these past 2 weeks working. I'm working 1 day a week. So this is my work day today. So we're kind of trying to juggle this thing where Stuart gets up and works for 3 or 4 hours first thing in the morning. Then I have my stint in the middle of the day and then he works again in the evening. So he still does his work day. So we're figuring it out. But I think, you know, he's 10 weeks old now, another couple of weeks, and perhaps we'll look at getting a little bit of help. Even if it's just 1 day a week, getting somebody to help with looking after him. I think it's starting to feel more comfortable for me to have somebody else look after him for a short period of time. But yeah, still a bit clingy with him at the moment.
Yeah. And did you find, because you were pregnant through lockdown, weren't you?
Yes.
How did you find that?
I didn't mind it. I think it really, because I'm sure like you, such a busy person usually, because, you know, I work hard and I play hard and I have a really active social life and I love to go to the gym and all of that. And I think that being in lockdown and just taking the opportunity to be out and about away from me helped me to rest more and focus a bit more on just being chilled and sleeping. Because I've got massive FOMO as well. And I think, you know, when you're pregnant, you just don't have the energy to do everything, but I would have been trying to. So I actually didn't mind it. And in the first few months when you're not necessarily wanting it to be public knowledge, it was much easier to keep that little secret as well. So I didn't mind it. But then obviously there were some things, there were some downsides. So Stuart wasn't able to come to all of the appointments with me, but the hospital we went to, he was able to come to the scans, which was great. But yeah, personally, it was okay. I'm glad it was during the pregnancy rather than now that he's been born.
Yeah. And you were working back in the surgery, weren't you?
Yes.
While you were pregnant, was that not, were you not nervous with COVID and everything, or you felt quite chilled? I suppose as a doctor you kind of know what you should and shouldn't be doing.
I personally didn't feel that I was at any increased risk working in the surgery, because I've had COVID. I think we had it at a similar time, yeah. didn't we?
Yeah.
Back at the start of the pandemic. So I've had it. And when it came to the time for me to consider whether to have my vaccine in pregnancy or not, the nurse that I practice who leads on COVID suggested, because you were meant to sort of weigh up the risks and benefits, and this is before we had the data from America saying it's absolutely fine to go ahead, she said, why don't we just check your antibodies? And I still had a high level of antibodies.
Did you?
Yeah.
I had none.
Oh, did you not? Like,
really not. Yeah, one of my friends, she was ill around the same time, and she didn't even feel that ill. Like, she'd gone for a run on one of the days before she realised that she had it. And I was floored.
Yeah.
And I, a few months later, had an antibody test. I had none and she still had hers. Yeah. I was so annoyed.
Yeah. So
you're lucky.
I know, lucky. So I knew I still had antibodies. And, you know, the reality is in general practice that the way we're working is different. So although we do see patients face to face, the number we see is much less. And I was wearing full PPE when I was seeing them. So I actually felt like I'm probably more at risk when I'm getting on the bus or on the tube on the way to work than I am
supermarket or something.
Exactly. So, and I have had my vaccine now, by the way. So.
Oh, have you?
Just to clear that up in case anyone's thinking, ooh.
Are you double jabbed?
Double jabbed. AZ. Mm.
So whenever I have a guest on, I always ask Instagram followers to ask questions.
Okay.
And I had quite a few in for you, I suppose, being a doctor as well, but I guess you have to watch what you say and what you do and don't answer. But I think most of them are aimed at you anyway. Someone's asked, has becoming a mum changed your perspective on certain things as a doctor?
Yes.
So not even personally, as a doctor.
It has.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I think particularly around childbirth. Because when I first became pregnant, I'd always thought that I would want to have an elective C-section, which is the most medicalized way to have a baby. And that was based on my experiences of doing 6 months in obs and gynae. And as a doctor, I'm on labor wards. So my experience of childbirth is women who were already high risk or who have come to labor ward because of complications. So that's what in my mind, what I thought I wanted. And it was really weird, like throughout pregnancy, like the medical voice in me got quieter and the maternal voice in me got louder. And I ended up having a home birth.
Did you?
Yeah. But what I realised is that I've learned all the medical stuff about childbirth, but I actually knew nothing about childbirth. I learned more from my hypnobirthing teacher and my doula than I'd learned in medical school about normal physiological birth. And I think, it's totally changed my views of that.
Births that aren't high risk.
Yes. So
just like a normal birth.
So yeah, if you take a woman who has no risk factors, who is completely low risk, who decides and successfully gives birth vaginally without any intervention, which is what's most common, I knew nothing about that. Like what happens, the hormones that your brain produces, the different positions that you may want your body to get into, the effects of different types of analgesia that are non-drug analgesia, such as water. Yeah, we're not taught that as doctors. We're only taught about, which makes sense because we have no place. Doctors have no place at birth like my birth was, which was, you know, as good as it gets. We are there when women choose to have medical intervention or when they are advised to have medical intervention because it's safer or when that becomes required during childbirth. So therefore I'd never really learnt about the straightforward, normal, low risk births. And when I did, it was like, yeah, actually that's what I want. I don't want to see it. So I ended up giving birth at home, in this room where I am right now, without a midwife present, which wasn't the plan. I did want a midwife, but they were late, and just with our doula there and Stuart, and it was, you know, a very, very lucky and very grateful that.
Were neither of you nervous? Was Stuart as calm as you were?
Yeah, we both were. Really? I was just in the zone because I'd got myself into the mindset of my body will give birth to this baby. It's got nothing to do with me. Like my body, women give birth in comas and I'm low risk. There's no reason. And I don't know. I just intuitively knew that it was going to be fine. So I kind of like just handed the job over to my body to birth the baby. And I knew that my responsibility was to stay calm, not get frightened, not freak out. allow myself to feel loved, because that helps the oxytocin, which drives the birth, and to do my best to tolerate the sensations that we call them. Mm-hmm. It was effing painful. that go with the childbirth. So therefore I knew I had to stay calm, because I was at home, and if I panicked, then it would, that would be.
Well, I suppose, well, I mean, I didn't have a vaginal birth, so I don't know, but in my head, I always imagined that it's the same with most things. Like, if the more you fight against it and the more scared and uptight you are, obviously that's going to tighten everything and make everything so much harder, and you're not going to breathe properly. And
exactly.
So I suppose the most relaxed you can possibly be.
Exactly. And
the
and
best it will be.
What I learned, which is just mind-blowing, that your brain produces oxytocin, and that's a hormone that helps the contractions, basically helps drive the childbirth along in the right way. But alongside oxytocin, your brain also releases endorphins, which are the natural painkillers. So you want as much of those two to be released from your brain as possible. If you get frightened, if you get scared, if you have a shock, if you, I don't know, go into a hospital and there's bright lights and people, then your brain will produce cortisol, the stress hormone, and that has what we call a negative feedback loop. So the more cortisol there is, that dampens down how much oxytocin and endorphins there are around. And that, you know, can delay things, which is often why, you know, and it's fine, women may experience that when they're going to hospital, things slow down for a while, and then once they feel comfortable, they're in a room, they pick up again. So even just knowing that and thinking, look, I don't want any cortisol, so I just need to stay zen. That's despite crazy. Everything. And Stuart, I mean, it wasn't quite as we planned. We didn't have a midwife. The birth pool didn't have the right adaptations for the tap, so we couldn't fill the birth pool, so we had to come up with an idea. And in the end, he ended up draining water from the bath into the pool. But yeah, it was all okay on the day, luckily.
God, I didn't know any of that stuff.
Well, neither did
none
I.
Of it. So
neither did I, so...
And you kind of touched on this earlier, but someone said, did you ever feel pressured to get him pregnant as you got older? And how did you kind of keep calm about it? Did you find people would start asking you about that as you got older?
Yeah, I think I probably felt more pressure from myself than other people. And it was something I talked about quite a lot with people, because I felt everybody's different, and I have friends that don't want to have children, and, you know, that's absolutely fine. I have friends that think if it happens, it happens. For me, I used to say to people, I can't imagine, I'm 41 now, I've lived half of my life, and I can't imagine what the second half of my life's going to look like if I'm not a mum. Like, what am I going to do? Like, I'm sure if for whatever reason I can't have children, I don't have children, I'll make the most of it. But I just can't even imagine what that looks like. So I'd put a lot of pressure on myself, and I'd frozen my eggs when I was 38. And before I met Stuart, I'd actually pretty much made the decision that I was going to go it alone, use a sperm donor and have a baby as a solo parent. And luckily, my knight in shining armour turned up. And I'm sure that would have been great, but very, very... And now I have a baby, I think, oh my gosh, that... How difficult.
Would have been so hard.
Absolute respect to all the single parents out there, because I can't, you know, now I can imagine how difficult that must be.
Mm. I can hear little man now.
Yeah, can you hear him?
Yeah, little newborn.
I know, he's upstairs with daddy, he's okay. Having said that, when I hear him, it does physically hurt my body to hear him.
Does
but,
it?
But, you know, I'm staying cool.
Do you know what this is? And I might be saying this wrong. Vaginismus?
Yes.
What is it?
So vaginismus is involuntary contraction of the muscles at the opening to the vagina. So people who have this can find it difficult or even impossible to have sexual intercourse. Okay. It's something that is much more common than I think we realise, because people find it very difficult to come forward and ask for help. And often when patients do present with this, they think, they'll often say something along the lines of, my vagina won't take a penis, it's too small, it's too tight, it can't. And actually, we know that vaginas all can. It's this condition called vaginismus, and it can be treated. So if anyone is experiencing that, go to your GP. If your GP's not that understanding, or, you know, because it is something that's not that well known about.
Yeah, I've never heard of it.
Just go back or print off some information off an NHS source and take that in with you. There's a really great doctor. I think she's the sex doctor or sex doctor on Instagram, and she often writes about it. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So, you know, it's something that is not dangerous. It can be fixed. It can be treated, and relatively common.
Okay. Yeah. Because they said it's really debilitating and barely talked about, and they were asking for tips on where to go. So that's amazing if they can go to the sex doctor or sex doctor on Instagram.
Sex doctor maybe for a bit more info, and then GP first protocol.
Take it to the GP. Great idea. And then finally, someone said, do you suffer with anxiety? Which we know you do. Mm-hmm. What are your coping mechanisms? I know you love to work out a lot. That's kind of, you're like a machine. Like even in lockdown, you got, I noticed you got all the women in your surgery, didn't you?
Yeah,
running, wasn't it? Or like just moving certain amounts of times a day.
Yeah, so we were doing socially distanced HIIT workouts in the waiting room when there were no patients there.
Yeah, it was quite entertaining to watch some of them. You could tell they were like, oh, she's got us doing it again. But do you find that really helps you with anxiety?
Yeah, that's my number one treatment, and I'm not currently taking any medication for my anxiety, but I have taken medication in the past. But I love exercise, I enjoy it, and I'm so lucky that I enjoy it because I know a lot of people don't feel that way, so that's really helpful. Yeah. But for me, it's my medicine, it's my treatment. I currently have anxiety that is well controlled because of exercise. It's been difficult actually having the baby, because after the baby, that's one thing. I've been going out for walks every day, and I've actually been seeing a pelvic health physiotherapist who's guiding me, so I can get back to exercise as quickly as possible. But 10 weeks in and I still can't do a lot of the things that I'd like to do. I can't run yet, I can't lift heavy weights, so I'm just being sensible and preserving my continence in the future. But that's my number one treatment. And breathing exercises is something that I can go to like in the moment. So I really like the box breathing technique, and just remembering to take those few moments, you know, 30 seconds to just catch your breath and take a few deep breaths to just ground yourself and center yourself. You're worth those 30 seconds is often my mantra.
Have you found that frustrating after having the better than kind of starting training again and not being able to do the things that you could before?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a newborn baby keeps you so busy that it's a bit of a distraction and you can't think, you know, trying to find the time to do it even if I could. But yeah, definitely. I did do one workout. It was the first weekend after Stuart had gone back to paternity leave. So I'd done the whole 5 days looking after him on my own. And on the Saturday, Stuart said, right, I've got him today. You know, I'll bring him to you when he needs to feed, but otherwise you do what you want. And I was like, I'm going to do a workout. So I went up to our spare room and I did this full-on workout and I felt so good. And then the next day I was like, I did more than I should have done, and I didn't feel great for it. So yeah, it's definitely something I'm looking forward to getting. I'm really looking forward to getting back to being able to do something like sprint up a hill. I just think, oh God, that would feel
so weird.
Good.
I wish I was like you. Yeah, you know what I'm really, really looking forward to? Sprinting up a hill.
Yeah.
Words that have never come out of my mouth.
And you know when you get to the, after your third hill sprint, you get to the top and your lungs feel like they're burning and you're out of breath and you're sweating and you just feel like, oh, that sense of relief.
Yeah, that third hill sprint, that third one.
There are some people out there that know exactly what I'm talking about, and other people are going, you are mental. What are you on about?
And have you found, like you say, you do have anxiety. Have you found it better or worse since having Lisbon?
Combination. I would say my sort of stable level, my sort of background level of anxiety is better. And I think that's because I care less about a lot of stuff that I used to care about. It's like I have this whole new perspective.
That's what I always say.
Yeah. Like if I've got vomit on my shoulder walking down the street, I don't care what other people see that. And so I would say my background level of anxiety is better, but my spikes of anxiety that I experience are a whole new high, because I think that's probably less linked to my having anxiety as a condition, as an illness, and more, I think that's probably what every new mum of a newborn experiences, like, you know, going to the shops, the supermarket with the baby in a pram, that background, that anxiety of at any moment this could turn into chaos and one or both of you could have a total meltdown. But I'm trying to reframe that as exciting. So when I go out and like your heart's pounding and he's asleep and you're thinking, please stay asleep. Mm. That feeling, which is anxiety, I'm trying to reframe and tell myself it's excitement and it's exciting having a newborn. And
doing all these new things.
Yeah. And I think the easiest thing to do would be to stay at home and just, you know, you feel safe at home. You can deal with whatever happens. But by calling it exciting and accepting there will be challenges, and that kind of helps me get out and about and feel like I'm winning when it goes well.
Yeah, it's a nice feeling, isn't it? When you're like, oh, that was okay.
Yeah, we went out for lunch and we ate lunch and nobody cried and that was great.
None of us. Well, at the end, I always ask people to give like their last three kind of tips. I was trying to think what yours should be, because yours is so varied. You're a new mum, you're a GP. I'm like, where shall I go with it? But I was thinking maybe as a new mum, and I feel like, you know, I've just written a book about being a parent, and I feel like as a mum, you often feel like you can't really go to GPs with problems with babies and stuff, because some GPs can make you feel like you're being a bit neurotic, or you feel like you're being a bit neurotic, or a lot of mums don't come forward when they're feeling like they can't really cope because we kind of feel like that's shameful and that someone might think that we don't love our child and our baby, or that we're not coping. So I thought maybe you could maybe give us three tips on helping yourself and coming forward. How would you encourage new mothers to come and speak and open up, I suppose, whether that's to a GP or a friend?
Yeah. And I think being a new mum myself, I understand all of that on a different level to what I ever did before. Mm. There's that huge sense of responsibility, isn't it, to be perfect. First thing I'd say is mental health issues, problems, struggles when you're a new mum are not just common. I would think it's the exception to not have any strain on your mental health because of a number of reasons, because of the hormones, because of the lack of sleep, because of this huge sense of responsibility, because your life has changed, your world has changed. So nobody is ever going to judge you. Even though it might feel like that, nobody is ever going to judge you. And if that is that you are actually suffering from something more severe, like postnatal depression or even postpartum psychosis, I know women feel that they will be judged as a bad parent, or sometimes people think, you know, if I share that, they might try and take my baby away from me. And the absolute opposite is true. As a healthcare professional, as a GP, I'm sure I speak for the vast majority of GPs. When a woman comes to you in that postpartum period and shares with you that they're struggling with their mental health and asks for help, that is brave. That is the most responsible thing that you can do as a new parent. And, you know, the important thing is in that particular phase of your life, there is help for you. There is help and support. So however bad it is, it can get better, but you must ask for help. Nobody's going to try and take your baby away from you. Nobody's going to judge you. People are only going to think how brave and amazing you are. And it's totally normal. And I don't know whether that's three tips or possibly even more.
No, I think that's perfect. That is perfect. It just sums everything up. I think anyone listening that's about to be a new mother or is a new mum, they definitely need to hear that. So thank you. I've loved talking to you. I've loved catching up with you. Aww. But also, I just think you're just perfect for the podcast. As I said, doctor, new mum, just a general lovely human. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Frankie. Lovely to catch up with you, and congrats on the new book.
Thanks. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Open Mind. I hope this has been really helpful to you. And if you have been affected by this episode or would like to find out any more information regarding mental health, then please head over to mind.org.uk. And please follow me on Instagram and look out for my stories where I reveal each new guest and collect all of your awesome questions to put forward to them. Hope to have you back soon. Are you trying to cut down on alcohol to boost your well-being? Well, personally, I love going out for drinks with my friends, but hate how I feel the morning after. And that's why I decided to moderate my alcohol intake with Atopia. They have an ultra-low alcohol spirit that tastes just as good as my usual drink without any of the nasty side effects or embarrassing photos. Looking after yourself is important, so why not take this month to get focused on your well-being? Join me in cutting down on alcohol intake today and start making the most out of every occasion with no regrets. Looking after yourself is important, so why not take this month to get focused on your well-being? Join me in cutting down on alcohol intake today and start making the most out of every occasion with no regrets. Wake up with a spring in your step and your well-being in check. Available from Waitrose and online.